Yeah, so today we're going to be talking about a little piece of history, and it's actually going to be Spanish history because we were out visiting Hammy, hence why there's a delay in this week's podcast. Spain, Madrid. So we went to Madrid and a few other places, but one of the places I kind of want to focus on is Toledo.
Hi, welcome to Wrong Side of Life.
I'm Sana Khan.
And I'm Jaime Vuelta.
We're friends and we thought about recording our chats.
Just because it seems like fun.
We talk about all kinds of things like society.
Tech, laws, zombies.
Zombies, food.
Of course, food.
Toledo is a very historic, antique type village that even when I close my eyes, I was just telling Hammy there, it reminds me of something that is straight out of a, you know, Assassin's Creed, a classic, you know, movie, a game, those beautiful, you know, villages that and towns that you see back in the medieval time that were able to withstand, you know, battles or the last town or village standing. Where the rest of the country would have been, you know, defeated. I think, Hammy, you live near it. That's the closest town to you in your village.
Yes, and I've worked for a while there, right? In Toledo, like I had a work there for a while. And I had my shop, the shop that we talk about in the other episode of the podcast, you know, was there. Like we went there visiting the old place when it was located. And but most of that when I was working and everything is what out of the old city, right? Like the old town is so Toledo is in a natural location that is very easily defendable, right? Like it's in a hill and is surrounded for almost everywhere for the river Tagus, right? So that makes it in the fact that, you know, you can only attack the city in one direction and it's uphill. So, and the other part is really hilly and it has like the river. We were going there to watch the city because there's some road that goes around all that. And it has like a beautiful view of the city, right? Of the old city and everything. Like we went there to watch it. So it's really a, you can see why it was chosen as, you know, as creating an important city, right? Because it's in terms of defense, is very easily defendable. So the city started in Roman times. Probably there was something before, right? But there's records of Roman times, like, you know, a
building
city
it up, maybe.
Yeah, like making that. There's even some remains of a Roman circus, right? The Roman circus.
Yes, I saw that. Yeah.
We didn't went that. Like it was close to one of the places that we went. It's just in a park, but you don't see anything.
You could see it from the hills.
Yeah, you don't see anything really that resembles too much like a circus. It's just like some ruins, like some rocks. But there was like a circus there. Like compared with the one in, there is the one in Mérida, which is another city in Spain that has like a more functioning circus, right? Like you see the circle. Like remember the circus is the place when they were doing races of horses, horse races and chariots and things like that. And you can see more like the shape of the circus, but here is not. But there's remains from the times of from Roman times and from then on, like since forever, right? Because later it was the capital of the kingdom of Hispania, but back then in the times of the Visigoths, right? When the Roman Empire fell, Spain was conquered by Visigoths, which were coming from, but now it's Germany, right? And they created, so they set their capital for back then their kingdom was about the whole area of like the whole peninsula, right? Like includes what now is Portugal. And it remained like that for years until, you know, until they fall when, there was the Muslim conquest of the peninsula, right?
And, and I think, Hammy, the history of Toledo is a very fascinating one. Mm-hmm. And Hammy, for those of you who don't know him, he is a bundle of knowledge. You don't need to pay for any tour guide. He had all the knowledge of the town. Is it a city or a town, Hammy? How would you describe it?
I don't know. I would consider that a city, given the history and everything. but yeah, I don't know. I think officially it's a city, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, so let's. I think a city. So I'll describe it as a city. When we were walking there, he was able to point out to us like the historical nature. And what's fascinating is the three global religions. Islam. You have Christianity, and then you have Judaism. They're all lived in such close proximity with one another. And what I found the most fascinating aspect of it was that, you know, you knew instantly to the floor markings. Like you were entering into the Judaism quarter, you would be moved over when Hami pointed out, oh, that's the sign that you're moving into the Islamic quarter. And then the rest was either Christians living there and occupying there. And naturally, where there is, such heightened religions, I think the fact that the city of Toledo tried to create peace, but as history has shown, even history right now is currently repeating itself. You know, these three religions, while being so similar in the foundations of one another, are quite, not compatible with one another from at least political and social perspective. And I thought that was a very much unique aspect of it, because we went to a few stores where they were selling, artifacts belonging to the city, and you'd notice that they have a section for Judaism, you have a section for those of the Muslim faith like myself, and then you had Christianity resemblance being sold, and in general just classic Spanish literature and history around it. So it's trying to cater for everything, and I think it's more accepting of its history now than it probably was back in the day, Hami, when people are fighting with one another and trying to divide, you know, like this land is my land, that land is your land, you know, that kind of that. It reminds me of that. If you come over to our territory, that means it's your fair game for, you know, whatever violence or persecution that may be suffered. But it's still amazing that it just, you know, if you just literally put your foot across from one side, you are in a different quarter entirely with a different belief, living and culture. So it's not just the religious aspects, the cultural aspects would have been different as well, Hami.
Yeah. So what happened is that during the Middle Ages, so Toledo was a center. Well, it was a very important city, right? Like the Toledo still had been renowned for centuries. So they were like very good at creating weapons like swords and things like that, and the swords armors, and it was a very very important city, right? And it was it was sometimes capital of kingdoms and everything, and it was a city where they have like the for a long time, like, you know, the three cultures. That's also why it's called the city of the three cultures, like Christians, Muslims, and Jews living on it, right? During the Middle Ages in Spain, so what now is Spain, it was divided in several kingdoms, and some of them were Muslim, some of them were Christian. And Jews were able to living in multiple cities, like mostly on the cities. And what happens is that when a part of that was conquered by one kingdom, right? Normally the people living there will remain, right? Like they were people that were Muslim living in Christian kingdoms, right? And people that were Christian living in Muslim kingdoms, and, you know, Jews also living in across them. So that's not necessarily, you know, that wasn't necessarily easy. Like, I think sometimes that's presented a little bit like, oh, and everyone was so super happy and everything, but at least they were able to live in that kind of thing. And they were, you know, depending on the king or depending on the historical moment and everything, they were able to live, you know, in coexistence, peaceful coexistence. And the fact is that there's a lot of things that are typical from Spanish culture in that era, right? Like, for example, architecture, that is greatly influenced by both of them, right? Like, there was this kind of art, which is called Mudéjar, which was basically built by Muslim workers living in Christian kingdoms, right? So we saw also in...
Sorry to interrupt. You're very much right about that, because I would be very familiar with the Muslim art. And I was like, oh, look, honey, there's, you know, like your bullring. Yeah. I can see the arches, the painting of the tiles is done in a certain way where there's a lot of blue and stuff. And look, the way that the Spanish embraced and utilized that Islamic art is fantastic. And it explains the beauty of it. And then there are times in Madrid, honey, where you have the classical Roman, designs of buildings, and some of your main central city center buildings are absolutely stunning. Like, I still think about how Madrid is such a beautiful city with so much history behind it. And I think oftentimes people forget about, the religious component of it, because Spain has been a key component throughout history in, you know, the conquistadors, the, you know, fight to stop the spread of Islam across Europe and the rest of the world. And I think it just seemed to be the natural resting place, maybe because it was from Northern Africa. Spain, out of most other European countries, would have that. Or would you be the same view, Hemi?
Yeah, so what happened in... You know, Madrid is a newer city, right? Like, because we went to both places, right? So everything that is built in Toledo is older than Madrid. Well, not everything, right? But you know the general idea, right? So a lot of the things that we saw in Madrid, they were perhaps 19th century or 18th century. Well, a lot of things in Toledo are way older than that, right? Like most of the churches and for example, we were able to watch to visit a mosque, right? That initially was a mosque, and it was built as a mosque, and then it was repurposed as a church, right? And that was super common, right? Like there's the biggest exponent is the mosque in Cordoba, which was the capital of the Muslim emirate when it was in Spain, in the Iberian Peninsula. And there was a mosque that was like, you know, amazing, really big, and you know, it's still in very good shape, that was repurposed as a cathedral, right? So now it's a cathedral mosque, or however you want to say that. But if you go there, like all the influence, right, like because it was built as a mosque, so it has like the Arabian arches and the colors, and as you said, like the you know, the tiles and everything, even though later it was repurposed, there's still like the building is the same one, right? Because the building was magnificent, and you know, it will be a pity to just destroy it. So it was reused, and that happens with a lot of very old buildings. Like we were seeing the mosque in Toledo, right? Like you can see clearly that okay, this was a mosque, and this one is is facing Mecca, and you know, this part is new, is newer, right? Like it's very old, but it's newer than the other part, right? And you can tell there's words of Quran in the outdoors in the wall, right? You were able to recognize that in Arabic and everything. So it's really quite interesting how that gets mixed, because obviously they're several centuries apart, right? It's like getting in a century that perhaps is 200 years old and say like, oh, this is a nice building, so we will add an annex on it and we'll use it for a different purpose that it was originally built.
Yeah, and I think that led me to the recent, because we're, you know, in history this has happened, you know, churches were converted to mosque could have been converted to synagogues and so on and so forth. The reason being, as Hami pointed out, when the ruling religion occupied the territory, naturally they wanted to make prompt impressions and to show that they were going to be stabilized and being around this place and kind of, we're not going anywhere, so that occupied places of religious buildings, and that was the easiest way to kind of reaffirm the religious stance now of the new occupiers. And what I found is, you know, what happened with the Hagia Sophia, that's the Istanbul, there was huge criticisms of, you know, how Turkey was, changing it and converting it back to a mosque. And I think what people, the ignorant people or those who didn't know the full history, were saying, oh, look how, Turkey is being, you know, anti, you know, religions or tolerant, is not tolerant, is taking over a church and converting it into a mosque. And I think the dialogue of that, Hami, was pretty much quite significant in the US, because it was seen as, you know, taking away the element of Christianity.
Well, it was, in that. It was originally built as a church, right? Then it was converted into a mosque. Later, it was a museum, right? Like in the latest years, it has been purely a museum, like a, you know, non-religious area. Like, you know, this used to be a church, then it was a mosque, now it's a museum, right, that you can visit and everything. And right now it's being repurposed again as a mosque.
And so for that perspective, if you don't know the history of, you know, that this is happening across the world, it doesn't matter that this has happened now, because it's in Turkey, which is a majority Muslim country. Mm-hmm. And so naturally it would have made sense. And it's actually being utilized a lot more now as a mosque than it would have been as a tourist facility, even though it's stunning as a tourist facility. But the point being, what I'm trying to say is, Hami, is that, you know, when something like this happens in modern society, it's as if, oh no, you're becoming intolerant and all of that. But it's something that has repeated constantly throughout history. Like when I went into that mosque, it wasn't that I was like, oh my gosh, they're anti-Muslims. I just understood it that this was just the way it was, because naturally they wanted to push out the Muslims. And then, as you mentioned, it was first the Jews, and it was the Muslims trying to create, you know, a more populated region for the Christian majority. So of course they'd want to occupy the place of religion, because they don't want to be kind of saying, okay, we're going to leave these religious artifacts around so that people can still remain. Why else would you bother to kick them out then, Hami? Do you know that kind of way? So in here, there wasn't actually anyone kicking out or, you know, pushing people away. But I just remember reading the news and looking at opinion pieces, and I think that was maybe my fault, Hami. When you go down a rabbit hole and then you see all these people thinking that they're experts in religion. I'm not an expert at all, but I do try to read all sides, and I think for anybody to criticize Turkey's move without fully understanding that this has taken place throughout time in history is a bit ignorant. There are also talks about, you know, look, in England, Hami, you know, Christianity, you know, elements of whether you're Catholic or Protestant or whatever sect of the Christian faith you are. There's a lot of churches that have been laid vacant. Mm-hmm. And they're saying that, you know, one of the fastest growing religions in the UK is Islam, given the fact that there's a lot of Muslim, you know, immigrants there. Mm-hmm. There's people with Muslim or Islamic backgrounds. So there are talks of, you know, rather than leaving these buildings unkept, because naturally, if you're going to have a mosque or another religious artifact being utilized, people are going to come together as a community to keep that building alive. But there's been huge criticism saying, oh my gosh, this is kind of, you know, the rise of Sharia law. And a lot of people don't know what Sharia law is, which makes me laugh. And look, Hami, I don't even think the Taliban in Afghanistan know what Sharia law is at the same time. But the point being is, it's the scare mongering that is around here. And in terms of that, it's just like, from my perspective, they're saying, oh no, we don't want the building to be used for another purpose. So just think of it as a repurposing, as opposed to, you know, giving it away. So, and essentially losing your history entirely. Yeah, so in the UK, you see the same thing where, you know, beautiful Protestant churches or Catholic churches or just Christian places of worship have kind of went to ruins or haven't been occupied for many years. And so what you're seeing is that, you know, because of the rise of those of the Muslim faith, because you have to remember there's different sects in the Muslim faith too. But in any event, because of that, there have been huge debates, and, you know, they're saying it's the rise of Sharia law and, you know, you're taking away our British identity and all of those, you know, British first unions are coming together. But when you ask those people, do you go to the church? Are you going to be funding it? Because the whole point is that if the government and the community's initiative is that if it's somebody that wants to use it as a place of worship, which is what it was intended in these churches, mosques, they were intended to be places of worships where you could reflect and kind of look at, you know, whatever God version you have in your mind. So if you take about that, that's what a church, a mosque is. It's a place where you kind of detox from the world and just say, okay, look at yourself inwards and see what life has to instill for you in this life and the next. That's the whole principle. If you talk about Judaism, Catholicism or Christianity, Islam, they all talk about afterlife, you know? So there's a lot of similarities, but when people become to start taking, oh no, Sharia law is so big and Sharia law is going to destroy everything, women have no rights. Look, you're looking at the interpretation of Sharia law of the likes of the Taliban. They don't even know what they want. All they want to do is interpret the religious wording in a way that it allows them to justify their actions. And that's what many tyrants do. Many dictators do. They take a religious or cultural significance context and try and interpret it, Hami, in a way that they can then justify their actions of, you know, murder, imprisonment, immorality, all of that. And in the context of those buildings, if they're handed over to people who are of the Muslim faith that want to take over and, you know, renovate the buildings, you know, occupy, that means those buildings won't get destroyed. They'll be maintained for future use and for historical purposes, because buildings are going to deteriorate if they aren't looked after. And the governments only have certain amount of money. So when I went into that mosque that was converted into a church in Toledo, I found it very fascinating because it's just what something happened in history. But it was a way for them to reaffirm that they are no longer Muslims. There probably were one or two or a few left behind, as with every mass immigration or exit of a particular faith in any country. But the point being is that they wanted to reaffirm, saying that this is no place for Muslims. We are now a Christian city, and even the mosque is where you can come to pray for in accordance with Christian faith. And there was nothing to be offended in my perspective of because this is just the way society is and history has shown us. So it's amazing when I'm reading and looking at the debates that constantly are happening right now. And then you look at across the world, this has happened so much, and including Sofia.
That doesn't necessarily mean that it was like an easy transition, right? Conquesting your city and saying like, now your church basically belongs to us.
Look, you're basically kicking people out of their homes, their places of worship.
And but I mean, they still have like their own neighborhood to live in, right? In that, like, I was thinking the fact that here, you know, here in Dublin, they made like this transition from a church, because I remember distinctively, right? I was crossing the street and there was a church, and I remember going through the steps of, oh, they're selling a church, right? Like the church is saying for sale. Next, a few months later, it's like, oh, they sold the church, right? And then a few months later, they were building some things, right? They were renovating it and saying like, oh, what are they going to do here? Like, is it going to be a church or what it's going to be? And then later it opened as a distillery, right? Because it's in a place that it's full of touristic attractions. So it's another one. It's a distillery thought to be also having like a visit to it, right?
Yeah.
So you can watch it inside and everything. And from even from outside, I've never entered, but even from outside, you can see that it's, you know, like, okay, this is a touristic attraction. And of course, they are doing also whiskey, but, you know, it's an interesting new life for an existing old church. And the church looks like a quite old one, so...
And Hami, that's so true, because I've also watched, I don't know about yourself, I've watched a lot of, you know, home renovations, these grand designs, that TV show. And there's a lot of people who buy beautiful churches who have been not used and misused, and they want to give it new life. Because if you see some churches, they have the stained glasses, the artifacts outside, you know, my only discomfort, Hami, would be that there's, you know, graves around many of these churches. So that would always freak myself out, thinking the spirits are around. And I think that would be one thing that would stop me, is about, you know, my superstitious nature and that, oh my gosh, if I wake up and I hear a noise, and it could be just like the wind in Ireland, you know, and I'd be like, no, what if that's the ghost thing? I've done something wrong, I've disrespected them, do you know what I mean? Like, so I was like, it's not for me, but I do like watching them. But you know, what is that difference, Hamid, than somebody buying a disused church, for example, or a disused place of worship and converting them for their own house? And they could be atheists, they could be Hindus, they could be Muslims, Christians, whatever. But people seem to generally be okay with that aspect. So then that means, but I'm like, sometimes I, you know, I don't want to get into that whole debate online because you can go, you're fighting with people endlessly. But it's like, okay, you're okay with a Muslim coming in, buying the church and making it into a home, but you do realize they're going to be probably praying the Muslim prayers in that church that so then technically has been converted. Do you know that? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like it's society picks and chooses, or those who are anti any of these things pick and chooses. Do you know what I mean? Like, if there was a historical mosque going to ruins and it, the it was in a Catholic majority country, I would understand the governments have taken over it to make use of it and bring it, make it into a place of worship for Christians or Catholics or Protestants. Do you know what I mean, Amy?
Yeah.
But I just think the scaremongering is quite significant, particularly in Britain, about these unused and abandoned places of worship from the Christian faith that have been now taken over by those of the Muslim faith, because it's kind of trying to say, oh no, you're losing your British identity, but then use the church, if that makes sense, or use the place of worship yourselves.
Yeah, and well, coming back to Toledo, right? Another thing that happened is that, you know, that was, you know, for a while they were living, you know, in different, the same city, different neighborhoods. And in some cases, probably there will be not that much mixing between them as you will probably imagine, right? Like you remember that, and something that catch your eye, that the fact that there were like signs saying that, you know, the end of the Jew neighborhood, right? In that there are some small tiles. I don't know if they're historic, probably they're new on saying that, but there were distinctive neighborhoods, right? Like the neighborhood, this one is the one with where the Muslim lives, this one is the one where the Christian lives, this one is one the one where the Muslim people lives and everything. So they were like living in sort of three different cities in one city, right?
Yeah.
And also another thing to note is that, you know, that worked during the Middle Ages. But there was at some point where the both Muslims and Jews were expelled from Spain, right? Like after the conquest of the whole, but now is the Iberian Peninsula by Portuguese, right? The Portugal Kingdom and the creation of the Spanish Kingdom, right? By joining of two big kingdoms by a marriage. Initially, they cast away they give the option of, you know, convert or leave, right? And so there were a lot of people leaving.
Yeah, I like point. That. Sorry to interrupt. I think this is a good point to emphasize because I found that I knew of it, but it was just kind of seeing in the city of Toledo and seeing the history of it. And then, you know, you've heard about it in books and movies and all of that. Yeah. But just this walk around it and you can see it was very fascinating. So I just want to say I found this part particularly interesting as well.
Yeah. So one thing that is quite interesting is the fact that, you know, the Jews that left Toledo, right? So the Jewish community is divided in two very big groups, right? Which one is the group that originally came from the Jews cast away from Spain, right? And the other one is the Jews that comes from the Eastern Europe, right? And there are people that and families that they still have their keys to their Toledo homes, right? So even now, it's 500 years ago, right? But they kept that by the family, right? The family kept their key of their Toledo home back in 500 years ago, and that has passed from generations, right? Recently, there was some initiatives from the Spanish government. So if you could prove that link, you could apply for a Spanish citizenship, right? To try to sort of, you know, right some wrongs that were done back then on that. The same thing happened with the Muslims, right? So initially, the last Muslim kingdom was the Kingdom of Granada, which is in the south, right? And initially, when Granada was conquered, which by the negotiation that came from that, right? Because they opened the city, finally they weren't able to really support it and defend it. So they kept to some agreement. The agreement included that the Muslim people that live there, they could remain living there if they wanted to. So they were, that worked for a few years, but after a few years, there was some revolts and everything because, you know, they weren't happy with the new situation that they were in. Finally they were like, okay, yeah, that's, you know, they lost their revolt and everything. A part of that was, okay, now you have to either convert to Christianity, or you have to leave. Right. So there were a lot of people leaving, to the point that in several areas in Spain, they were like Muslims were the one that carry all the know-how for certain occupations. Right. Like, for example, building the tiling. Right. Like the tiling that it's very distinctive of the south of Spain and the east coast as well. They were the ones that were doing all that, right? So when they were cast away, there was like a significant drop in the quality and the outcome of the tiling and everything, because there were no workers, right? No skilled workers, because they were the ones that has the know-how. And the people that converted, right, 100 years later, they were like a lot, because they were always a lot of suspicious about people that converted, whether they converted truly or not. Right, there were a lot of accusations about people carrying over their faith, right, the old faith at home, right, but putting a facade on outside to say, yes, I'm Christian, but you know, at home I'm still praying in the Jew way or whatever.
Yes, and so in secret.
In secret. So there was a lot of accusations, and finally, like 100 years from then, right? So 400 years ago, they were forced to be expelled. So they were also a lot of people that. Technically, and I don't know if by heart or not, we will never know, they converted to Christianity, but they were forced to be cast away because of that, because, you know, suspicious and, you know, not really believing that they have really changed their ways. And that was not, you know, that was not the people itself. It was like their grandkids, right? Which is quite unfair, but... That's what's
fascinating. Did you ever find out, or was any kind of stories written by those people, as in 100 years later, those even who had converted to the faith in order to stay behind, did they ever write a story of what happened to them? Because I would imagine then, if they were trying to get back into their old faith or the faith of their ancestors, they may have also suffered persecution.
Yeah, I don't really know exactly how where. You know, like, I imagine there will be a lot of stories. There's nothing really in particular that I know of, at least, you know, but I know that most of them move to the north of Africa, right? Which, well, now will be Algeria or Morocco. So they live there. Like, there was communities also of Christian people in Algiers and, you know, the north of Morocco and everything for a long time. So perhaps they were a little bit more... tolerant with the people of mixed faiths or whatever they were doing, right? And the Jew people in the same way, right? Like they a lot of them move to the north of Africa. Some of them move to the West Mediterranean, and they were, for example, in places that will be now Turkey and also like the Croatia and you know the Adriatic, all that part. They were like a lot of people expelled that were living there, right? They were communities like the Jews expelled from Spain. They kept the language, right? They still speak to this day, right? There's people that still speak that old Spanish, right? That there is their own set of Spanish, which is not like the modern one, but is based on the old one and has evolved. In parallel, right? So it's still sort of recognizable as Spanish, as crazy as that sound, but it's like difficult to understand, right? To me, at least, it sounds a little bit like an old way, right? Like when you're reading an old book, right? 500 years ago, right? Like when you're listening to Shakespeare's works or whatever, right? Like it's not the same language, right? It's different. And they kept that. And there's even like I think there was for a long, long time a newspaper written in that language that was done. What city was? I think some place in Turkey. That they were doing, you know, there was a community big enough to support this, the handling of a newspaper, and it was in this language, right? So there was a Jew community big enough that kept the language 500 years ago, from 500 years ago to this day, right? That they will still use that language.
And I think that when while we were there, we were looking up all of these historical discussions and having it. And then Hammy pointed up of the rock of Gibraltar. Am I saying it right, Hammy?
Gibraltar.
Yeah, well, Hammy does it with a beautiful Spanish accent. So, you know what? Listen to him as opposed to my Spanish attempt. But there was like a Spanglish, like, the you know, that there's a, because of the history with the UK and the Spanish. And so that region can speak, you know, a different version of Spanish. And you, Hammy, you said you can understand it, but you can tell.
Yeah, so it's a weird thing. So what happened in Gibraltar, right? Gibraltar is in the south of Spain, right? Just in the Strait of Gibraltar, that hence the name. And it's and it was conquest by, you know, British people and has been a British colony since 300 years ago. So obviously, the people living there, they are British subjects. I think it's no longer a colony technically, but there's a lot of, you know, it's like an how it's called, overseas territory.
Overseas territory, yeah. Kind of like what Isle of Man, Jersey, Guernsey, those Channel Islands are.
It's something like that. You know how complicated the UK is in terms of, you know, territories and everything. But yeah, it's a little bit like, you know, some island in the middle of the Caribbean or something, right?
The
legal status.
Like Cayman Island or British Virgin Island, you know? They have their own kind of culture, but they connect themselves with the UK just on certain aspects, but they have their own kind of laws and et cetera.
Yes.
But they follow closely with what's happening in the UK, but they're separate. They're part of it, but they're not part of it. But
it's quite a complicated relationship,
Yeah.
And Gibraltar, it's a little bit like that, right? Like it was a colony for a long time, and the people there, but the people there, obviously, you know, UK is far away and Spain is very close, right? So they all were speaking Spanish, right? And they were speaking Spanish in addition to English, right? Because especially like what people were saying from there is since they started putting like everyone in school, right? Which is not that far away, like 100 years ago, all the school system is in English. And it's a bit very British English, right? And it's the official language and everything. But everyone sort of, you know, just because they are very close by to Spain, they speak Spanish. And the interesting thing is that they speak Spanish with a very strong accent from that area, which is south of Spain, that has their own, you know, their own strong accent, right? Like it's an area with a strong accent. And what they're doing is that they're mixing that all the time. So they are speaking English with very strong British accent for two sentences, and then they do three sentences in Spanish with a very strong accent from the south of Spain, from Andalusia, right? So it's quite very difficult to follow that because I understand that because I know English, so I can sort of follow that. And they are also words that they mix from one language to another, right? So they say a word in Spanish that is really a translation or a direct copy of the English word, for saying something. So it's quite strange and fascinating because Gibraltar is so small. It's really, really small, right? So there's a massive rock, which is like a rock in the middle of a plain. Like you wouldn't believe how much, you know, normally mountains, you get like a lot of mountains, one on top of each other, right? Like very, very close. But in this case, you have like a massive mountain, like it's lonely, right? And Gibraltar is basically that and just a little bit more, but not more, right? And in Spain, I went there like a couple of years ago. And there's a border control, right? A big border control that you have to cross. There's an airplane laneway that you have to cross as well. So you, if there's an airplane taking off, you have to wait until, you know, it's like waiting for the traffic lights until other cars are crossing, and then you cross over, right? And then you get in a city that is very, very small, right? It's basically one street, but it's very British in construction, right? Like, and you have like the typical red phone booths, and you have you know, all the shops and everything. All the architecture is very British in essence, and also like most of the people working there are really people coming from Spain to work there. So it's an interesting part of the world.
Yeah, and I think that area, even though, it's, as you mentioned, it's just a tiny rock, literally, but there's people living there and there's communities there, but neither the British wants to give it up and the Spanish still wants to have an interest. And it goes back to, Hami, the debate that you probably constantly see is that, you know, in between Israel and Palestine, why yeah. don't the Palestinians leave, for example, and just find a place? But where are they going to find a place? It's the same with, you know, the territory that Israel is trying to occupy more and more of the land because they claim that it's theirs. And hence why there's the back and forth in the fight. And I think Jill Barter is, when I look at it, I just think that, okay, it's more kind of, there's not as much violence. There's actually no violence in it. But the point yeah. being is, Hami, they don't want to give it up. Do you get recovery problems?
I think so. In Gibraltar, the main thing. So from the point of view right now, right, and there was in the 90s, late 90s, there was like some talks between the Spanish and UK government about what, you know, what was going to happen if it will be a co-sovereignty kind of thing or something. So from the point of view of Spain, it has always been like quite a contagious thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, It's something in the middle of that, and it has like it's a big story about, you know, what happens there, and right now it's quite like a tax haven, and it's in an area that is full of drug trafficking because, you know, a lot of drug is crossing through the strait, and you know, people from the police force from Spain doesn't consider that the Gibraltar's force is doing much. Gibraltar force is like, you know, two policemen or something like that. They don't really have like a lot of thing, but, you know, it's an area that is quite contagious and everything, but there's always like a lot of border issues with, no, you can't cross this line because, you know, these waters are Gibraltar waters and not the Spanish waters. And, you know, the people with a boat that are carrying a lot of drug are moving through that to avoid the Spanish police and et cetera, et cetera. So it's a quite contagious area, even if it's very, very small, right?
But that's what my favorite is, because it's entry into the UK, and the drug trafficking is quite big because, you know, yeah. Spain can get the drugs from North Africa smuggling in, not saying that it's the North African countries, but look, every country mm-hmm. has drug problems and smuggling, all of that. And I just love your reference of, you know, a two-man or two-woman police
yeah,
force.
Yeah, like, you know, the police force in Gibraltar, I imagine, you know, is like three people or four people. I don't think it's bigger than that because it's quite a small thing, like, okay, let's say 10, right? But I don't think it's a big enough. And so there has always been like a lot of contention about that. But the people, like the people from Gibraltar, right, they don't want to be part of Spain, right? They also have like a very advantageous position where they basically a tax haven, and they have yeah. like a lot of shady activities going through, right? Like in their banks and things like that. And, you know, their bank laws are quite opaque, etc. And they have like a lot of things. And they also have, it's one of the biggest places in the world for online gambling because their laws that they have, they're quite permissive in terms of yes. online gambling. And, you know, they obviously don't want to give up all their privileges in that, right? So if they were part of Spain, they don't know if they will be able to keep all that, right? So they don't want to be, and they have been saying that quite strongly. At the same time, I think from the point of view of London, they are not really that interested, right? Which is a sort of similar situation yeah. that happens in a lot of things. Like England doesn't seem to care about other parts of the UK, right? Like, okay, if they don't want to be here, it's fine for me. Like if they want to still stay, it seems more an inconvenience, but, you know, what are they going to do? So there has been like sometimes more negotiations in the 90s, right? In the we were part of the European Union, not anymore, et cetera, et cetera. So it was like, okay, let's try to, you know, do a co-sovereignty kind of thing or whatever. And the people in Gibraltar were really, really strongly opposed about that because, you know, they don't know what's going to happen. Now with Brexit, who knows? Because, you know, like it's really an area that has been hit very, very strongly by Brexit to the point that the agreement with the UK was that basically Gibraltar stays in the EU. Right. So they yeah. have to follow all the rules in the EU, et cetera. And even then there's a border, right? But the border never disappeared. And the border it's weird in its way that it can sort of be enforced in certain cases based on the agreements in the Spanish and British government and everything. So they have this situation that right now it's suddenly became quite bad for them, and they are just sort of stripped away from the UK, a little bit like the Northern Ireland, right?
That the
tension is a little bit like, okay, you can't really be in the same situation that you were before, that you were both in and out of the European Union, right? Like now you need to choose what you want to be, and really being out is really, really painful because of all the things that you're doing. So you could be being in, which means being away from UK, right? And that risking the fact that, you know, it could split away from UK. So it's an interesting development. We'll see what happens. Like, the thing is in Gibraltar, right?
There's been much discussions about it, because I find that people aren't discussing about it. I'm not hearing much about, you know, the fallout of Brexit and how it's affecting the likes of, say, Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
I think COVID has distracted it, Hammy.
Yeah, well, in Northern Ireland, we know that it's having a lot of effects, right?
Yeah.
It's just that it's sort of scary what could happen there, but, you know, we never know what is going to be. In Gibraltar, obviously, it's like much, much smaller, and it's sort of like, from the point of view of the UK, they don't really care that much because it's tiny, right?
And, oh, yeah.
You know, and it used to be a very strategic location, right? Because it was controlling the Strait of Gibraltar, which is the natural crossing between the Atlantic and the Mediterranean Sea. But that was, you know, in the old world, right? Right now, they don't have really a problem of what happens if Spain wants to cross, stop the crossing of goods from, you know, that comes from our empire in India and move to England, right? Which used to be in the 19th century a big thing. And that's why Gibraltar was so strategically important. But right now, it's not that much that problem, right? Like there's freighters and that go from a lot of places and everything. But in terms of, you know, what is going to happen there, like I don't know. Like it's right now, what I know is that, you know, the agreement that they had is that basically they have to be in the same situation that they were before. So they are forced to use follow a lot of regulations, and to the point that they're supposed to be using border patrols from the European Union to protect their borders, which weren't doing that previously. And again, perhaps that will mean that there will be a better control of, you know, the drug trafficking and everything in that area, which will be a good thing.
Yeah, so I think from my own perspective, it's like, you know, the solutions always don't ring a bell. Gibraltar is essentially an offshore haven. Mm-hmm. A lot of, I think, wasn't it a time, Hammy, that there was the world's largest number of online casinos was hosted or being based in Gibraltar?
Yes, yeah. It's a place where online gambling is quite important because they have like very, very lax regulations on that. So
that's how these countries survive. And to use your quote, the country like England, it doesn't have the capacity to be focusing on all these little areas because it can barely handle itself. So those kind of countries, whether it's the British Virgin Islands, Cayman Islands, Jersey, mm-hmm. Isle of Man, they all have some sort of offshore element to it that makes it more easier for, that makes it easier essentially for people to create, you know, non-traditional businesses or to create complex trust structures to hide their identity. Yes, it's more difficult now in light of changes to the money laundering regulations across the world. But the point being is, for their own survival, they have to kind of turn a blind eye to what traditionally, major countries would not be more open towards, mm-hmm. whether it's online gambling, whether it's, you know, offshore islands and creating trust and corporate structures to hide the beneficial details of who's ultimately behind this corporate entity so that they can evade their tax perspective. But that's how these people make their money. Otherwise, they're not getting handouts from the UK government. And anytime they do get some assistance, it's not even going to cover off, for example, a day's living and running and operating of these countries, because there are actually people living in these places. So they can come across as highly populated in certain areas of these islands or small rocks, as they would describe Gibraltar. So I think it's an interesting proposition, and the future of how these countries are going to survive given the fact that laws have been introduced, Hami, to make it difficult for these countries to kind of attract foreign direct investment in these mm-hmm. areas that are essentially their survival rate. It's amazing. One thing I find is that Northern Ireland never really got that offshore label. They mm-hmm. weren't able to follow Gibraltar, Jersey, Guernsey, British Channel Islands. They just simply kind of went along with what the UK was doing for it. And I don't think that has done the Northern Ireland any good so far. So Brexit, as regards to what Northern Ireland has happened, I think COVID-19 has delayed matters, Hami. That's the only thing I can kind of justify. That in my own view, you know, there should be a lot more negative repercussions happening. Yes, we hear over the news about, you know, the struggle to import goods into the UK because of the lack of lorry drivers. But I don't think the true extent has actually been identified. I don't know. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think we are still early days on that. And yeah, probably COVID has been something that covered a lot of things. Both for good and for bad, right? Probably we weren't focusing on all those things, right? But yeah, like the thing in well, also Northern Ireland is quite peculiar in a lot of ways, right? And the fact that it has a border and the border needs to remain open and everything, it creates a lot of challenges on how to deal with that, right? Because, you know, the basic agreement on that was, well, effectively right now, like they have their internal market broken, right? Like, do you need to do border checks for goods traveling from Belfast to Liverpool, right? And that's sort of an avoidable thing of having like an open border with between Belfast and Dublin, right? Or between the Republic and Northern Ireland. And it's probably going to have like a lot of rippling effects. It's very difficult really to foresee what is going to happen, right? The fact that the COVID and also because COVID has been and it's still being a big shuffler of things, right? Like, it's going to shake a lot of things, and it's very difficult from now or the point that we are in time. It's very difficult to know, but probably is starting to have like a lot of effects that we won't be able to see until a couple of years, right? And we will get back in hindsight and say, oh yeah, this happened during COVID. One thing that is starting to be quite obvious is the fact that because there were so many people going home, right? Either with some payment, right? To allow them to survive and everything, but they basically left their job for some time. And now they're having to go back to the job. And because there's so many people, there's a lot of effects going on that, right? People that say, okay, I prefer going back to, you know, wherever I was, like perhaps there was a, you know, police truck driver. I don't want to be doing the driving lorries anymore. I want to be doing something else. Or perhaps I don't want to work with these companies. I prefer to work with these ones, right? And it's even happening in engineering, right? Because there's a lot of people that got out. They have been working at home, right? And right now they don't really want to go back to offices. So when you think about that, that could trigger a lot of effects on people. Okay, I actually don't like my company. I will move to another company because they are perhaps more flexible in terms of allowing me to work remotely. And because it's happening with so many people, right? Because COVID affected like the whole world, it's going to have very big effects, even though right now it's very difficult to really foresee them, right? Right now, one big thing that is happening is that there are works that are starting to open and there's problems getting people to get to those jobs, because they don't want to accept the old conditions, right? They want new conditions, whatever that may be. Like perhaps they are paying too little, or perhaps they are, you know, not allowing work remotely, or perhaps they are, you know, the conditions of, again, that with the lorry drivers, it seems that there's a big thing about all the paperwork that they have to do, right? And they need to do a lot of paperwork for work for 3 months. And they said, like, look, this is not worth it, right? So I will search for other works, traveling goods in continental Europe, but not necessarily going to the UK.
And I think that is the exact same discussion that we've had in Ireland at the moment, where because the housing crisis, it's very difficult to buy properties, and sizes of properties are all, you know, smaller properties for more higher prices. So people are trying to escape having to the west or the countryside. Mm-hmm. So they can get bigger houses, and the property prices during COVID-19 also increased during people's search for working remotely. And it can be that you can work remotely for an Irish company while being in Spain because you're in the EU, for example. Mm-hmm. And so you can have that lifestyle of, you know, being in a nice, you know, could go back to your own home country. But mm-hmm. I think the remote environment will be an interesting proposition to see how it actually be rolled out, particularly if you're working for companies, Hammy, in my personal view, that say it's an Irish entity. Unless you work with them in Ireland for a few years to build that trust, I don't think that kind of option is going to be available to many people, that you can just say be in France or Spain and find an Irish company and say, okay, we're going to work from Spain or France, because it's easier for us. We have our you know, the finding accommodation wouldn't be as hard, because it's true, accommodation here is horrendous to find. I've never had a positive experience, I'm sure, Hammy, based on our conversations, neither have you. It's always kind of been like, you know, it's for want of a better word, you feel desperate when your landlord was saying, okay, we're going to either sell the property, or, and you're like, okay, how do I find another accommodation that's nearby?
Or even when, you know, it happened to me that suddenly my landlord has said, like, well, look, I'm going to increase this for 200 euro a month. And he's like, what? Right?
And that's a lot, Hamid, you know? Yeah. And so I think, in terms of that, I'd like to see how it rolls out. Have I bite? I definitely think working from home and remote working is going to be here, but I don't know how good it will be from an international perspective, at least at this stage, at least in my own view. I think it'll happen in the future, Hammy, but I don't know when or how it's going to look, because we're still trying to recover and get back into the office in Ireland and elsewhere.
Yeah, well,
in terms of that.
In terms of the, like, the working from home, right, I think that technology sector is probably going to be leading that, right? Because that has been a trend for the last 10 years, right? Like, it's not necessarily something that new. It was something that it was software in certain conditions, right? Not everywhere. But, you know, I know people that in previous companies that I work on, they left and they were working from Romania. And, you know, it was perhaps a new thing and people were seeing how it could work and everything, but finally they were able to make it work, right? Yeah. And they were working from Romania and they were working from Spain and remotely, and perhaps once a month or once every couple of months they were coming for a meeting, right? And after that they will go back and keep working remotely, right? Fully remotely. So I think it's something, and that happened like, I don't know, 5 years or 6 years ago. So I think that's something that definitely is going to happen. Now, I don't know how massive will it be, right? Like how much really, because I don't know if I like the 100% remote all the time, right?
Yeah.
Now, I don't know, right? Like I'm still, you know, when I started the work that I currently have, it was when we had the pandemic, so I don't even know them physically yet, right? It was a place here in Ireland, but, you know, it could be whenever, wherever, wherever, because the it's really just talking to people on Zoom, right? And it's going to be, yeah, but now we are planning about, okay, what are we going to do when we go back? Are we starting this way? Are we starting this other way? But in some cases, right, like, does it make sense for us to go back full time on an office? Like, probably not. Like, I have meetings that are at 8 a.m. in the morning sometimes. It's way more convenient for me to take them at home than to take them in the office. And really, I'm having them on Zoom. So why I'm, you know, I can get that in at home, right? It's way, way better for everyone. So that doesn't really make any sense of me having to travel and everything. So we'll have to learn how we are doing that. So it's interesting because right now it's starting. Like, it probably will take a couple of months still to try to get back everyone at the office or whatever arrangement suits everyone.
Yeah, but for me, Hammy, I always think that I'm going to do the remote working with in-person attendance where there's key meetings and stuff, because I think commuting has, that's what I just love about not working in offices is the commute aspect of it, Hammy. That, you know, if you had a bad night's rest, you can still, you know, wake up a bit later than you usually would and still start work at 9. Do you know what I mean? Or if I have to wake up at 6 to get to work at 7, for example, if there's urgent meetings and time zone differences, I'm totally okay with that. Do you know what I mean? So for me, I think I'm definitely from the stance of working remotely. And I know more and more people are trying to secure kind of deals with their offices, saying that, okay, can we work from home for about a month or 2 months during the summer? Because we've recently bought a holiday property. And a lot of people did that actually, Hammy, during COVID-19. Because they said, wait, if we're in the EU, we can work anywhere. And that's the beauty of being in the EU, because I know it's going to sound very nerdy, but from a privacy perspective, you can work there no problem, because your company would have less hesitation for you to be working in another EU jurisdiction, because the data is kept and maintained and throughout the EU ecosystem. And so they don't have to introduce additional security controls just for your accommodation of moving abroad. So I know this because I've talked to people who have made requests. That there was Hammy, one individual, he was going to, I can't remember, it's blacklisted in the EU, and from a sanction perspective, I think it could have been the Ukrainian Crimea area, and they wanted to work remotely from there, for example. And, you know, from an operational standpoint, you can. Technology allows you to work anywhere, Hammy, as long as there's Wi-Fi. But there was a legal implication as an American company where there's sanctions against, you know, Crimea and Russians. You can't allow that to happen, because essentially you're circumventing the sanctions laws. So I think the legal implications need to be considered, because you're essentially going to expose yourself. And a lot of people sometimes don't think about that. But then this company, the one of the companies that we were, I was looking at that particular moment, they were proactive in raising that. And I felt sorry for the individual, saying, well, sorry, you can't work remotely, essentially. But the point being, it was for the greater good. As an American entity, as a European entity, you have to comply with sanction laws. Otherwise, you know, it makes it difficult. So the truth is, there is not endless possibilities, as a lot of places would describe, Hammy. I think that's what they do in the advertisements. If you see some of the jobs, endless possibilities to work remotely whenever you want, that suits you, as long as it's okay. No, there isn't. There's laws, regulations that actually can dictate whether or not you can work remotely. And then it goes down to the operational considerations too, Hammy.
No, it's I mean, it's a lot of possibilities, probably not endless possibilities, but, you know, a lot of them. And I think we are going to be seeing that quite often, right? Like right now, I imagine that when people are looking for jobs and people are offering jobs and everything, they will say, okay, you can work remotely, or these are our things. There's also companies that have been remote, totally remote since the beginning, when they were, you know, the inception of the company, right? And they have teams that are distributed all over the world, and they work in that way, and everything. So it's definitely possible. The thing is that I think it will become more mainstream than it is at the moment.
For those of you who don't know, in our previous podcast, when we were talking about games and pastimes, I challenged Hammy to a game of chess. The reason why I'm saying that is because when we were in Toledo, we purchased a historic Toledo steel. Is it Don Quixote?
Don Quixote, yeah.
I was close. I eventually got it close to it. But Hammy will tell us about Don Quixote, because he was everywhere. I also brought him back with me as a knight. But we purchased Toledo steel, because that's what Toledo is known for. Beautiful steel and handmade designs, chess pieces. So, you know, we're getting close to a time where the challenge will have to take place and see who's going to come out as the victor.
so it's a character. So Don Quixote is a character in a book that was written 400 years ago, right? And the full title is Don Quixote de la Mancha. La Mancha is a region that is close by Toledo. Toledo wouldn't be considered La Mancha, but given that the administrative region of that will be Castilla-La Mancha, right? Castile-La Mancha. It's sort of mixed, right? And there's a lot of things in Toledo with Don Quixote and everything because he's sort of like the hero of the region, right? Is a very, very important character in a book, and it's a book that is considered, you know, it was the first novel that people consider, right? Like the introduction of narrative so big and so long and everything that will be considered like a novel, like a modern novel. And yeah, it's like very well known, and especially there, you know, like people will create a lot of things reminding of that, and the character will be everywhere, right? Like you will see him because it's this guy that the main idea of the book is that this guy that reads so much stories about knights, right? Medieval stories about knights, that he gets crazy and believes that he's a knight himself, right? And this is the old man that is no way, you know, no good enough to be a knight, a real knight, and is completely out of context, right? So it will be a little bit like imagining, you know, someone reading so many old or watching so many old Westerns that he believes is a cowboy in modern society, right? So it's a similar idea, but in, you know, 400 years ago. So he's completely out of time. He's following all these kind of stories about, you know, magic and knights and wizards and magic and, you know, damsels in distress and, you know, this sort of, how it's called, like, you know, the sort of knight round kind of adventures, right? But he's thinking about that. He's looking at, for example, there's a very famous passage when he's looking at windmills, that there's those windmills in the region that are very famous. And he's thinking that they're giants, right? So he charged with his spear and his horse towards the windmills. Obviously, it ends bad, right, on that. So is about this character, and he's always accompanied by a peasant that is called Sancho Panza, which is sort of like the realistic part of the of that, right? That he's completely the opposite. He, instead of watching the world and seeing that magical and, you know, high elevated and everything, he's looking at that as it is, in the very realistic and sometimes pessimistic views, right? So it's a lot of the book is based on the two perceptions of the character, right? Like how they react, how one is like so high morals and trying to do like the, you know, the very optimistic kind of thing and always ending bad, and the other one trying to withhold him from doing something very stupid, like, you know, charging with a spear over windmills.
Because he was everywhere, Hammy, and I was like, oh, look, yeah, that's knight. And you're like, nope, that relates to Don Quixote. And then even the chess pieces, I was like, oh, look, they're nice. And he's like, nope, that relates to a scene from Don Quixote. And I was like, right. So that makes sense. But I think what I found depressing in that is that the guy goes crazy because he's read too much. So it's kind of like a tale of Hammy. Don't be too clever and start reading a lot of books because your mind lives in this world of Walter Mitty. So I think it's probably the first kind of...
Yeah, it's a little bit a Walter Mitty kind of character. Right? Yeah. That's a good way of describing it with a newer character, yeah.
But he's a fascinating piece. It was everywhere in that, and I would really recommend people to check it out. And I think I didn't know, because we had been to Spain multiple times, Hammy, but it was just coming to Toledo. I don't think a lot of people know about it, even though it's not too far. That's what
I found. It's quite close to Madrid, and is worth to go one day, right? Like, I mean, you can spend more time if you want. There's more museums. There's pictures that you can watch, and obviously, you know, it's a very historical place. You can eat also very well, but as a day trip, right, from Madrid. Because obviously Madrid has more museums and more things to do. It's like the capital, it has a lot of things. But as a day trip, is completely worth it. And there's like a high-speed train that you can arrive from Madrid in I think, 45 minutes or even less than that. And everything is very walkable, like you saw that. I mean, it's walkable as in tiring walkable, because everything is uphill.
We were climbing up a hill and I was like, give me a few seconds, I'm out of breath. Do you know what
it's,
I mean?
It's all because the whole city is in the middle of a hill, right? So it's quite difficult to be all the time. But it's, you know, you can't really go by... the other thing is, like, really, people really avoid trying to... If they live in Toledo but not in the old town, they avoid going in, right? And especially by car, because it's quite complicated, and you shouldn't use the car to get into the streets, right? Because you could get stuck. Right? There's so many streets that are so narrow that your car could get stuck, and you could hit something or whatever. There's people that live there and they use the car. I don't know how they do that, but you know that I don't know, people crazy enough to do it.
And the whole point is, if you go to it, if you love history, I think it's a city that you need to explore. And if you like religious history, it's a city that you need to explore. Because and all I kept saying to Hami, this is, reminds me of the city of Carcassonne, that game, the board game. It reminds me of you know, Saint Malo, where everything is walled, like it's on top of a hill, and the hill is surrounded by water. So if you try and even attack it, those within this city will know that it's been under attack, so they can get all their, you know, weapons and their bridges upwards, and the hills out there, if you don't know it, you've gone down some narrow roads, and if you're not fit, because naturally the people live there are used to going up and down these heavy you know, tunnels. It was like going back in time, but I mean, we had Wi-Fi and stuff like that. It was just an amazing thing to see. And then
and a lot of tourist shops, right? Like, you get a lot of things to sell you swords, which is the typical thing to get that. There's still like a couple of people, because Toledo was renowned by their steel during the Middle Ages, and even before that, and until the invention really of like gunpowder. They were like sort of the best swords and the best armors, and everything was built there. And there's still a couple of people that do things in the old-fashioned way. But normally they, you know, they also sell like a lot of swords made with modern, you know, modern machinery and everything and done. But, you know, it's very impressive. You saw like a lot of, you know, all those things that they sell, like a lot of armor or swords, all kind of swords. Like, you want the Lord of the Rings swords, or you want like all the historical swords, whatever, they will sell that to you. And, you know, shields and things like that. There's a lot of that to get that. And another thing that was quite known for is the, I don't know if you remember those kind of, it's sort of plates that they have like a lot of intricate designs.
Yes, the gold ones that's made out of steel, hand to steel. They're very, very expensive. Yes. I was looking at a little hourglass and it was like 160 euros. Like, okay, no.
Yeah, they're expensive. But, you know, if you like that, that's also something that is quite typical from there.
Yeah, I know. I think from my perspective, I can see myself going back. It's just nice. Madrid is stunning. There's no comparison. Look, but the point is, if you like history, and you know what? If you want exercise, there's no need to go for a long walk. Go up there. Your 10,000 steps are going to be, I think, Hami, I did the most, using my Fitbit, they said, wow, you've done the most stairs you've ever had. You didn't say, Hami, about that, the lifts or the escalators that was actually built in. That was amazing. Yeah.
There's like a couple of escalators, because you can go up into the mountain. Yeah, it's like to access the old town, right? Like you can really walk through the general road, but it's quite uphill. So the only entrance is one. You remember the place we were in, a place eating churros, because, you know, we were in Spain, we were eating a lot of churros. And there's this big gate which is called Puerta de Bisagra, right? In the front. And that's like sort of the main road, right? Like that's the traditional road. And I mean, you can walk through that and everything. But if you want to go to the sides, there's not really any way that you can really go from one point to the other. And they build big escalators right in the mountain to you to be able to move there quickly, right? Instead of having a single entrance, you now have three walking. And you can bring the escalator. But it's quite interesting because, you know, they go very, very high. Until they drop you on the top of the old town, right? So it's nice to be able to have that option to, instead of just walking, take an escalator and go to the top, and perhaps if you want to go down, right, like that's easier.
Yeah, no, the escalator was the most fascinating aspect, and we just went on it for the crack, and then we tried I tried to be like, I'm going to climb one of the stairs, because every few seconds there's a little break, so that you can just get off and walk to the next escalator, and I climbed up one of the stairs, and I tell you, I was like, this is very intense, so I can see why they needed the escalators to actually get you into the city very fast, as opposed to climbing around the city is how you'd get into it without those escalators wouldn't it be Hemi, or you have to drive into the city and then walk
around? You can drive. You can drive. So the thing that, which is what we do, we did right, is if you go to the main, through the main street, at the end of it, there's like a convenient parking, right? And that part is quite easy. It's a big road. It's you know, wide enough a street that you have no problem, right? You just go up, and then you park in the parking space on top. And then when you go down. It's another road, but you know, it's also easy to navigate, right? And that's what I normally do when we are visiting, because you know, you arrive in the top, and the top, you know, you have the Alcázar, you have the Zoco do Ver, the plaza that we were eating something and everything. So it's quite convenient and around everything. The cathedral is not far away and everything. The people normally what happens is that people avoid. If they live in Toledo, they avoid going to the city center as much as possible. And normally, all in the old town, only there's like a few banks, perhaps, but most of the amenities, you know, like things that you have to do, if you have to go to the bank, if you have to go do some paperwork on, you know, for something, everything is out of that, because in is quite complicated to enter and it's not very convenient. The thing is that there are a lot of things like hotels, touristic places. If you want go out for having a dinner or whatever, you will have to go there. But normally, you know, try to control the times that you go there. When I was working there, because you know it's more beautiful and everything. When we were doing meetings and people from other companies were coming, we will have like the dinner and everything will be in there, and the hotel will be in there and whatever. But normally, they are coming and. Even to the point that one day, for one meeting, that they were coming people from all the European Union, we hire a bus. We pick everyone from Barajas Airport. We brought them to Toledo, right? So they didn't have to worry about renting a car or having any kind of thing, right? Like they was just in the old town, and they only had to walk right from the hotel to the place where we were having the meetings, and that's it. So they didn't have to do all the inconvenient stuff.
Yeah, and I think churros was something that you just touched base. You have to have churros, and there's nothing that beats good Spanish hot chocolate, which is, you know, that thick churro sauce. So you can both use it with your churros, and then you drink the remaining amount. So I think talk about efficiency. We did buy lots of churros, and I'm already missing them, Hemi, because there's nothing that beats a nice, warm, freshly made churro. And the thing is, like, when we came back to Ireland, the weather is now freezing. Like it's sunny, but it's like the chill. Yeah. And in Spain, it was 22, 23 degrees.
That weekend was quite good. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was like perfect for me. Not too warm, not too cold. And the breeze, Hemi, was just absolutely beautiful. But now I know that we're back here. It's winter is coming. Do you know what I mean? Like I just keep thinking that's the one thing in Game of Thrones that stuck into my head. Yeah. Winter is coming. And in Ireland, we all talk about winter's coming more so than summer's coming, because of the fact that the winter can be, you know, long, wet, dark. Like you wake up in darkness, Hemi. You go to bed and finish work in darkness, like 4 o'clock. Like I'm seeing that at 7 o'clock, it's getting dark now, Hemi.
It's a difference. But anyway, you know, like summer is off. We are starting autumn. Autumn is not bad here in Ireland. Sometimes it rains a little bit too much, but you know, other than that, is fine. But yeah, the moment it starts.
When does the weather change in Spain then, Hemi? At least in the Madrid area and the Toledo area,
you will normally see find the difference around now, right? Like probably middle October, perhaps. But, you know, the moment October comes, it's always like a drop in temperature, right?
Yeah.
Which is noticeable. October normally is fine. November until mid-November is okay. And after that, it will be quite cold. So that area will have like 0 degrees.
Which like I find the most strange, because I was like, Madrid gets cold. And Hemi's like, no, it gets really cold.
Yes, it gets very cold, and it gets very warm in summer and gets very cold in winter. It's short, like it will be perhaps that temperature, right between 0 and 5 will be for a couple of months, no more than that, right? Like normally what is December and January. February, normally it starts to get a little bit better. But those 2 months are quite cold.
Yeah. And then think for those of you, we might talk about more offshore islands because I'm heading to Isle of Man for some time. So there will be a slight delay, but we'll do our podcast when I'm back, Cammy. So probably, you know, if those listeners will be in a week and a half time. But winter is going to definitely be there, Hammy, because it's just surrounded by the Atlantic Ocean. And I'm just, you know,
picking out the clothes.
Everything's warm, hat, scarf, gloves already being looked at. And you know those big puffy jackets, Hammy? Mm-hmm. I'm even thinking about bringing that for myself, you know, just big puffy jackets and doing that because you're surrounded. And I remember the last time I was in Isle of Man, it was dark. Okay, it was winter time and I know now we're autumn. I doubt there's going to be a huge difference in the temperature. But I tell you, trying to find flights, trying to find you know, ferries, all of the direct routes that used to be available back in the day, just a few years ago before COVID-19, Hammy, they're gone. There's no direct flights anymore, at least in the winter times, from what I can see when we're looking at to Isle of Man or even, you know, other offshore Channel Islands. You have to go through UK and for us, we're going to Belfast. And the ferry trips, we thought, oh, we can bring out our car and so it'll be easier to drive around. Nope, there's no ferries. And I think that could also be to do with Brexit, maybe because Brexit, those ferry routes were also being used to bring supplies to the Isle of Man. I don't know. I find that, how do you say, Hammy, strange? Because in my past experience, I used to work for a company where they had offshore jurisdiction presence predominantly in the trust and company service providers. Basically, it was a company that sets up entities for you. You could be located in Spain, Hammy, and say, I want you to create a company in Isle of Man, Jersey, Guernsey, for example, and operate this on my behalf. And I'll just pay you fees to maintain and, you know, keep the company alive and file the annual reports, etc. And it could be done to create, you know, family wealth structures, all of that. So essentially, I mean, there was direct flights. Now there isn't. And I think that's because the regional or those small airline providers have actually been the ones who suffered the most with COVID-19. The lot bigger companies like Ryanair, Aer Lingus, while they've struggled, they've had enough resources to keep alive. But those small countries, more small companies, Air Aran, Hammy, that went bankrupt. And I still think, in my own personal view, is that, you know, there's still not a full discussion being made as regards to the impacts of COVID-19, the fact that people weren't working, where the money's coming in. I don't know, Hammy. I'm surprised about all of that. So I think in the near future...
Well, we have the bandwidth.
Sorry, Hammy?
We have the attention bandwidth that we have, right? So it's we can only focus on a couple of things, right? And when there's something new, it's like, oh yeah, we are looking at that and everything. But yeah, like I imagine there will be a lot of surprises coming.
Yeah. So guys, if you don't know about Toledo, I hope you know about now. And I can't reiterate enough that if you have an interest in history, if you like going to Spain and if you love churros, okay, churros can be found anywhere in Spain, okay? but it's an added benefit. Why not? You list it as an attraction. You know, if you like churros, come to Spain.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is, you know, the city itself is beautiful, right? Like there's some really fantastic views on that. I will recommend the one on the viewer, right? There's this road that across the other side of the Tagus that you can watch like the whole city and everything. But basically everywhere you go, right? Like there's a nice spot for a picture to take in like some interesting buildings, some interesting bridge.
Oh,
right?
The one thing I have to say is, sorry to interrupt, it's just the quiet pace. Yeah. Like people are going around doing things. Like I'm back in Ireland and I'm already back in a chaotic phase running around because the car parks, there's lots of car park spaces there. Even when the shopping center we went to, Hammy, here we were in Blanchardstown doing some errand just before our trip. And my goodness, it was as if it was Christmas time, Hammy. Like there was no car park spaces available and people were on top of each other. They were hooting at each other, you know, and I was like, wait, this is the pace of life. Even though it's a lot slower, and I was just felt calmer there, Hammy. At least
Toledo is quite quiet and calm, right? It's not a stressful city at all. Like it's even perhaps a little bit too much. Like if you try to find some, I don't know, some lively action, like, you know, bars and everything, it's not that much. You won't find that. You know, I imagine you've saw the difference between off pace between Madrid and Toledo, right? But it's like quite noticeable.
Yeah, no. So hopefully you guys enjoyed our history of Toledo as well as a common political commentary about everything because of the fact that when you're talking about, I think, Toledo, you can't but reflect what's happening in modern society. Mm-hmm. And it makes you reflect on, you know, the arguments that people are kind of saying, you know, repossessing of, you know, former religious buildings and giving them repurposed just so that they can survive. And I'd rather see a building survive and be respected as opposed to, you know, being destroyed naturally.
Demolished, because, yeah.
You know, so that was my viewpoint on it, Hammy, on mm-hmm. all of the history of it. And I still remember that there was that, you know, the signs of you are now in the Jewish quarters. They had the tile written. I think mm-hmm. that's just fascinating. It just felt like I was back in time in history.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we didn't enter, like there was a synagogue that we didn't enter and everything, but we saw that, you know, from outside.
And there was a huge queue to the cathedral. Like you literally, there was about 60, 70 people waiting in line. And I was like, let's just keep going on because there's so much to see. But if you were there for like 2-3 days, you could spend it there on a casual pace.
And there's also a couple of places because there's also not only the cathedral, there's a lot of beautiful churches. And there's a couple of very, there's one that is a very famous painting that is in like Iglesia Santo Tomé in one of the churches, which is like very good and, you know, very big and everything. And you enter the churches basically for watching that picture and everything because it was from a famous painter that he was originally from Greece, but he lived in Toledo for many, many years. It's interesting because he was sort of like pre-impressionist, like 300 years before impressionism. You know, because he made everyone like sort of elongated and everything. And he was like living there and painting and everything. And it was quite interesting. So there's like a lot of other things, right? Like obviously we went only for a day and sort of doing like a quick tour of the city and trying to see the city itself, right? Most of the things from outside. But there's a lot of very interesting small places that you can go and learn a lot as well.
And great exercise.
Yeah, great exercise, yes.
So thank you for listening.
And you can follow us by searching Wrong Side of Life podcast in the internet.
See you soon.